1380 AM Columbus, W224 EG Madison, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Chuck Sievertson. Resolving criminal charges over a scandal of leaked classified U.S. military and diplomatic documents. A plea deal between the U.S. Justice Department and WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. Court documents unsealed tonight. Hearings in federal court in Florida on Donald Trump's handling of classified documents. Defense lawyers asking for dismissal. The Biden campaign marking 2 years since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, with events in several states, including Arizona. Vice President Harris and Phoenix.
In state after state, laws have been proposed and passed that criminalize healthcare providers. You know, in Texas, they provide prison for life for a doctor or nurse who provides healthcare.
As the July 4th travel period's underway, Americans are paying on average 13 cents a gallon less than last year for gasoline. Says data from the Energy Department, the average price for regular is $3.44. This is ABC News.
I'm Terry Bell with WMDX News, your news roundup in quick podcast form. Find it anytime on the WMDX website at mad.radio.
Civic Media News, I'm Ella Saff. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. Milwaukee tourism had a historic year in 2023. Visitors spent over $2 billion in Milwaukee County. That's a quarter of Wisconsin's 2023 tourism profits. Visit Milwaukee President and CEO Peggy Williams-Smith held a press conference ahead of the Republican National Convention's arrival in the state's largest city.
We believe in economic development based on tourism. The more people we can bring in to go to shows at the Pabst across the way, or the Riverside, or the Symphony Center, or come to Summerfest, we know that that helps the entire community.
The RNC is expected to attract 50,000 visitors to the city of Milwaukee. The National Weather Service has confirmed 6 tornadoes touched down in Wisconsin this past Saturday. Tornadoes formed during severe thunderstorms from warm, moist air. Higher temperatures and severe storms could be causing more tornadoes. We've had more than 30 so far this year. And that's what you need to know. I'm Ella Saff, and this is Civic Media News.
Welcome to the Lazy Oaf Lounge, Madison's East Side place for friends and family to meet for fun and food. Stop in for great daily lunch specials, soups made from scratch, and jaw-dropping burgers, wraps, and sandwiches. Plus Friday fish fry and homemade pizza cooked in a classic stone hearth pizza oven. The Lazy Oaf Lounge, 1617 North Stoughton Road in Madison. Follow them on Facebook or at LazyOafLounge.com.
This is Mad Radio 92.7 WMDX.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
You're listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Woke up this morning, got a message from a listener going, hey, did you see this? Chris Kobach, you know, from the Kobach Commission during the Trump years to do cross-check across the country to throw people off the voting rolls. You know, Chris Kobach, the voter suppression guy. Well, he's Attorney General of Kansas, and he's got a new crusade, you know, going after immigrants and going after unions. Yeah. In fact, Chris Kobach, very angry at the Department of Labor. They have come out with a final rule that he has taken exception with. He says this rule is not just a violation of the law, it is bad policy. Chris Kobach goes on to say, once again, the Biden administration has placed the interest of foreign nationals over the interests of United States citizens. He says, giving unionization protections to a class of employees naturally drives up the cost of doing business for employers. So again, going after the immigrants, going after unions, because why would we want them to make decent wages? Now, he's not alone. Chris Kobach, not alone. You got 22 Republican attorneys general who have signed on to fight the U.S. Department of Labor on this new rule, which what the new rule does It allows agricultural workers who are here on H-2A temporary work visas to have concerted activity to make their workplace safer. Concerted effort to ensure that they don't get cheated out of wages. Basic wages, hours, conditions kind of stuff. Workplace protection, that gives them the ability without fear of retribution or punishment or beatings. Gives them a little bit of a foot to stand on. Now, what's interesting is you've got these attorneys generals, and you know the states, Kansas, Georgia, South Carolina, Arkansas, Florida, Idaho. You can join in Indiana, Iowa, Louisiana, Missouri, Montana, Nebraska, North Dakota, Oklahoma, Tennessee, Texas, Virginia, and others. More, I'm sure, will come. More red states who want to go after those immigrants. And, of course, those unions. Because, look, right now, the Republican Party is all about, going after the immigrants and the workers. It's that simple. And what I find interesting is I read a good portion of the law, that this final ruling that they've come out with. Now, understand, Republicans are very clear in wanting to make sure that workers are exploitable. So the idea of collective action, they hear collective, their mind just explodes. They hear concerted activities, mind explodes. Now, Kobach is accusing this administration of giving foreign farm workers something that American farm workers can't have, because our laws are so badly broken that American farm workers, under federal law, bans American farm workers from collective bargaining. It's what happened, all those years ago, and we've never fixed that. So instead of saying, hey, maybe we fix that, no, Chris Kobach says, no, nobody gets nobody. Now, what I find interesting is they're going after, Joe Biden's putting America last. This is a great talking point. It's great for talk radio. They're going to give these immigrants rights. How dare they? But if you actually read the final rule, and again, I did, it's very clear. And I quote, the final rule does not require H-2A employers to recognize labor organizations or to engage in any collective bargaining activities such as those that may be required by the NLRA itself or by state law such as California Agricultural Labor Relations Act. It is specific, written right in the final rule. This does not give them collective bargaining rights. It gives them the ability to have concerted activity without fear of retribution or reprisal. Very different. This is saying that you can band together for mutual protection to fight for better wages, hours, and conditions. Like any association, you look at the trucking association, they've got their thing, the owner-operators association, there are all of these groups out there that they have some level of protection in numbers. What this is doing is saying, look, these foreign workers who are here as guest workers, they've gone through the process. They got the H-2A visa. They're here working. We should give them some level of protection. Now, why did I bring this up today? Because I thought it was quite ironic that when I got this message, within an hour, I got an email from the U.S. Department of Labor that points out that they had gone after a Nebraska construction company operating in Southern California and blatantly, as they put it, blatantly and willfully discriminating against U.S. workers by bringing Mexican workers into the U.S. under false pretenses, shortchanging their wages, and putting their safety and health at risk and in substandard living conditions. What they were doing is they were bringing people in saying, these are farm workers. They brought them in under these H-2A agricultural visa program. They brought them in to do farming. And what did the operators of R&R Cristo Construction LLC of Fremont do? Well, they put them to work in construction. Now, the Department of Labor forced them to pay, you know, wages of almost $300,000 in back wages to these workers, and, you know, almost $64,000 in penalties. And look, you know, again, slap on the wrist. It just is what it is. These companies keep getting away with this. You don't see R&R Christo Construction going to jail. But I found it interesting that here you have this situation where they're right in the report. This company abused this program, deliberately misrepresented the fact that these foreign workers were coming here to do agricultural work when in fact they were, as the Department of Labor says, they were employed for construction jobs at a San Joaquito poultry operation. The judge accordingly found the employer profited by abusing and exploiting vulnerable, unsuspecting H-2A workers by misrepresenting the nature of the job. The employers discriminated against U.S. construction workers and discriminated against workers here and failed to meet their legal obligation by employing agricultural workers. You read a little bit further down and you found out that the division learned of the situation after a referral prompted by Cal OSHA, which had investigated injuries suffered by these H-2A workers after falling from a roof. Again, you have one thing happen, and then a bunch of people start looking. They got cheated out of overtime. They got cheated out of wages. The housing was deplorable. In fact, they said that they had like 11 cots in one room. And you go, why do guest workers need some level of protection? R&R Christo Construction kind of rings a bell. And as they point out, look, the reality is, under California law, employers must pay construction workers 8 hours after working 8 hours a day and 40 in a work week. Employers can't pay H-2A workers less than what's required under the law. And yet here they were, surprise, 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 here they were cheating these workers out of wage. And what were they doing? They were lining their pockets. And this isn't new. This stuff happens in a lot of places. It happened, you know, here in Pennsylvania years ago, where you had, you know, people here on visas who were supposed to be, you know, student work visas, you know, working, you know, 100 hours a week at a fast food joint, living in a house, 15 people to a basement, while this company was making huge money, not paying them overtime, and in a lot of cases, not even paying them minimum wage. And I argued at the time, you know, they were here on a visa to experience America. And I said, you know, they got an experience, all right. They now know what it's like to be a low-waged worker in this country. They now know what it's like to be left behind by labor law. But I found it ironic that, you know, someone would send me this story, like, can you believe this? And look what they're doing. And then this story pops up. Now, am I surprised that Republicans are okay with exploitation like this? No, I'm not. And you shouldn't be either. But it is angering. And if there are problems like this in our labor law that farm workers can't unionize, maybe we fix it. Maybe we go and we fix the law to help make lives better. I don't know. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, Michael Sonato, reporter over at The Guardian, is going to come share some thoughts on some big labor stories. Back after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So an interesting story coming out of California. About 6,000 grocery workers at the Kroger-owned Food for Less. As we speak, they're voting on whether or not to strike. Their contract ended on Saturday. It expired. They haven't gotten a new contract. And they're saying, look, you know, going to have to put that strike arrow in the quiver. And here to share some thoughts on, well, you know, what this could look like, what it means, and why we're here. I've asked Michael Sonato to come talk with us. Michael's a labor reporter over at The Guardian US. Michael, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me on again, Rick.
So I look at this 6,000 grocery workers said, you know what, wages aren't good enough, benefits aren't good enough, we demand better. I'm not surprised, you know, given the last couple of months, but what's going on?
This Kroger-owned chain, Food for Less, these workers have, toiled through, they've got this company through the pandemic. Their stores in Southern California are, you know, some of the top revenue producing grocery stores in the area, but their wages lag pretty far behind other grocery stores in the areas, the average being, you know, over $4 an hour. Difference between a grocery clerk at Food for Less and a grocery clerk at Ralph's, and some of the benefits, their guaranteed hours are worse also, and they're just asking to be brought up in line with the rest of the, you know, the chains in the area at Kroger, and these grocery workers have been, you know, fighting Kroger for the past few years. They were criticizing the company. They got rid of hazard pay during the pandemic. Kroger shut down stores in response to local areas of California enacting that $5 hazard pay for grocery workers because, you know, of everything they were put through during the pandemic. And they're still reeling from those issues. So, you know, these workers are putting their foot down. Kroger, multi-billion-dollar company. The workers have been on strike in different areas in the country, at this grocery chain. And, you know, for the past year and a half, they've, been trying to push through another merger, trying to acquire the Albertsons chain. Workers with UFCW have been, sounding the alarm, saying, you know, they've done mergers like this, and what happens is jobs get lost, or, you know, if worker, even one of the workers I brought back, they worked for a grocery chain 30 years ago, they got laid off and got called back at the same grocery store, different brand name, their wage got cut by like $7 an hour, they lose their seniority. So they've been fighting all these different things, and this is just, you know, the next chapter in that story of workers, taking on this company.
No, they've seen this movie, and it doesn't end well for the workers. It does well, I'm sure, for the corporate CEOs and the executives and the shareholders, not so much for the workers. But, you know, here's the thing. You know, it's Food for Less. It sounds like it's Work for Less. That sounds what it is. And I guess as we speak, as you've reported, they're already looking for scabs to come replace these workers in the event of a strike?
Yeah, they've had signs posted up in stores, open interviews, looking for replacement workers in the event of a strike, which just goes to show you, where they were thinking. And that was a couple weeks ago before the contract even expired. So, they're ready. But these workers are ready to go out if need be. The results are set to be out probably late Friday night, given, you know, they're over in the West Coast, possibly right. Saturday. I'm not sure how early the strike will be called, but We'll see if the strike vote gets the company to make any movement. Right now, they're pretty far apart on wages. They're, you know, asking for that over $4 an hour increase, and the last best final offer from the company was, you know, a little over $3 over 3 years, so like a dollar. So it's pretty significant. So we'll see where that happens.
Yeah, what's interesting to me, though, you know, the fact that they are advertising for scabs to come and replace these workers, is we know in these situations that these companies are willing to spend enormous sums of money to get scabs to cross the picket line. We know that they're willing to spend, you know, millions and millions of dollars to get these scabs to force a bad contract on workers, but yet they won't spend that same money to make their workers happy. It's really twisted. And, you know, just yesterday we were talking about IKEA. And IKEA, you know, a couple years ago had a people were leaving. And they said, hey, what can we do to keep people from leaving? We want them to stay. So what'd they do? They raised wages. They got better working conditions. They got better benefits. They did the things that, you know, make people want to stay.
Yeah, and that's unfortunately the modus operandi of corporations in this country. They'd rather spend, you know, more money fighting their workers, fighting unions, than, you know, what would it take to, you know, give them a fair contract.
It's again, it boggles the mind, but because I don't believe it's about the money. I think it's purely about the control. It's about the, we don't want to, and we're not going to give in to you. So we'll see on Friday what happens here. I got to get some thoughts on your other story that caught my attention over at John Deere. John Deere won a good contract for their workers, decent wage increases, decent benefits, a company that's wildly profitable. And now we see that they're laying people off. They're firing people, moving jobs to Mexico. Is that true?
Absolutely. They've laid off. They've announced, you know, 650 official layoffs and just in the Iowa plants. So far this year, over 100 workers taking early retirement. There's been some layoffs at the Illinois plants, and they announced the very end of May that they plan on, you know, enacting more layoffs. They didn't give a number, but, you know, they're anticipated that those layoffs are going to happen sometime in August. They did announce in 2022 that they plan to phase out some lines and move production to Mexico by the end of this year. And they are opening another plant in Mexico, which is expected to be open in 2026. And they're moving that production from the U.S. to Mexico. And like you said, there's no reason for that. This company's making money hand over fist. They're spending a lot of money on stock buybacks. It is a cyclical business. They've been known to enact layoffs, but at this scale, it's pretty, unheard of. And it, you know, it's going to be interesting to see kind of how the opposition to these comes out. That, you know, the Biden administration, it hasn't gotten into the political realm. It really hasn't been, up on that radar. The UAW, the national union, hasn't said anything. One of the local presidents, criticized John Deere for outsourcing for these layoffs. From my understanding, they're, you know, in talks to see what they can do to at least mitigate what's going to happen. But it's going to be something to keep an eye on. Because I think it could have big political ramifications if a company like John Deere is, you know, outsourcing hundreds of jobs to Mexico a few months before the election.
No, especially in places like Iowa and other states where John Deere is big in. You know, we were in Ottumwa, Iowa during our Working Class Heroes tour, and the John Deere plant, that was the job in the area. The fact that, you know, you could possibly lose more jobs in that area. A lot of the small towns we went to on our tour, you saw the kind of hollowing out that I would expect if John Deere were to leave. So this isn't good news, but this should be a bipartisan, nonpartisan political issue, because you got Trump who was saying, hey, we got to keep manufacturing here. You got Biden who's trying to reshore manufacturing. This should be something that would unite the country against John Deere on all sides of the political spectrum, don't you think?
Yeah. And, you know, John Deere makes a lot of money off of federal contracts. So it's not like there's nothing that politically can be done. On top of the fact of the matter is they're moving production to Mexico, but they're sending that product back into the USA. You know, this is their main market. This is where they're making money. So, you know, the only reason to do this is to exploit the cheap labor costs, you know, in Mexico. And there are, you know, political avenues, whether it's, you know, tariffs or, you know, leveraging federal contracts to get John Deere to at least, you know, back off on, you know, some of their plans.
Now, you mentioned that the company, you know, wildly profitable. And in fact, in your reporting, you said in 2023, they made $10 billion, over $10 billion in profit. They paid their CEO $26.7 million in compensation. They spent $7.2 billion on stock buybacks. So they're not hurting. So the other question that comes out of this, since they're not hurting, it's not about the money. It seems like to me, and maybe you've got a thought, and maybe in talking to these workers, maybe they had a thought, that this seems like retribution for what happened during the strike and the fact that John Deere had to cough up a little bit more money than they thought they should have to.
You know, there were some concerns, too, that, you know, this could be, you know, scaring workers ahead of the next contract fight in 2027. You know, because with that Mexico plant planning to open in 2026, there's, you know, if they're moving production from U.S. to that plant, there's going to wind up being more layoffs. So that's certainly a concern from workers that I've spoken with.
Is there anything, you know, in talking with some of the leadership, is there anything that can be done, do you think? Clearly, it's going to be a political football issue, but is there anything that can be done? I mean, you know, this company's going to move production to Mexico, and as you said, they're going to bring those products right back here, like it was made here, and you know, and try and pawn it off as such. Is there anything that they're saying? Hey, we need to get this done. Biden needs to do this. Is there anything yet concrete of a path to stop this?
You know, unfortunately, I haven't seen anything. And, you know, after my article went up, I saw on Reddit's John Deere site, there was, you know, someone purporting to be a worker talking about how management is treating these layoffs. That, you know, they explained, you know, we've seen layoffs before, but something is different. Something, you know, the attitude from management, the kind of that, you know, just disrespect is kind of something they haven't seen before. And that's concerning, you know, concerning that workers are getting that sense, and concerning that there have been significant layoffs already. And, you know, there could be more. You know, they said there are going to be more. It remains to be seen. You know, John Deere did not give me any information. They did not want to respond to my questions about what's going on. And from what I've seen the past weeks since my story came out, they've been mum about it. So, you know, another frustrating thing is 2022, the trade adjustment petition, which provided workers impacted by offshoring, that lapsed.
Yeah.
So now, you know, the transparency, it, you know, we lose a sense of transparency with that. And these workers, they lose, you know, I think there was a U.S. senator that kind of pointed out there's a big discrepancy between workers who get this trade assistance and workers who don't in terms of their income afterwards. So, you know, that's going to have a big impact with the fact that, you know, they don't have any resources or support anymore. So.
Yeah. No, I mean, the people who got trade adjustment assistance in the past, that I've known a number of people who've had to use this, unfortunately. Generally, you get like 2 years of unemployment as long as you're going through like a training program, and they help you get into a training program, either through a community college or some type of trade school or something, to help you find that next job. There's actually a path to help you get skills and training to get the next job. And there is a little bit, there's more unemployment and some other things that come along with that. So when that goes away, and as you said, you know, thanks, Republicans, and some Democrats too, but mostly the Republicans, ended this. And, you know, now these people are going to be screwed, because I guess the argument now is, well, it's not trade. We're just leaving. We're abandoning the workers in the country. I guess that's the argument as opposed to a trade argument. No.
You know, I guess so. Yeah.
Because I can't come up with another one.
No. I got nothing for you either.
It's amazing stuff to me, but I'm sure you'll be keeping an eye on this, and I hope you'll come back and keep us up to date on what's going on here. But it's angering, absolutely just angering. Michael, I appreciate the time as always. Great having you on the program. Thanks so much.
Yeah, of course. Anytime, Rick.
Michael Sonato, labor reporter over at The Guardian. Make sure you check out his work over there at The Guardian. Great stuff. We'll get some links out on social media. You can check the latest pieces. Want to hear your thoughts. Do you think it's retribution? Or do you just think it's just pure, absolute greed? Hey, there's more to be made by cheap, exploitable labor, by lax environmental regulations. We can get more for us and less for them. I want to hear your thoughts. Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Right back.
You're listening to Mad Radio WMDX, Madison's home for the Todd Lobel Show.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Severe thunderstorm watch continues for the area. Scattered showers and thunderstorms tonight. Some could be strong with heavy rainfall, damaging wind gusts, and large hail. A low in the low 70s. Sun shines back for tomorrow. Not as muggy, but warm. Highs upper 80s. We're sitting at 84 degrees right now.
Looking for a place to kick back, grab a bite, vibe out on great music? Look no further than the Rigby in Madison. They're not just a pub. They're where the action is, with something different every day. Rigby Oki Mondays, Trivia Tuesdays, Single Nights on Wednesdays, and live music Thursdays, Fridays, and Saturdays. Located a block off the Capitol Square at 119 East Main Street, stop by and take a tour of the venue spaces for your next private party. And the rooftop space is now available. For venue reservations and details, email Chelsea at events.rigby@gmail.com.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So you may remember last week we spoke with Culinary Union Secretary Treasurer Ted Papageorge about Trump's wild and, well, out of the blue campaign promise to tipped workers that we were no longer going to tax tips. And we got a ton of email agreeing with Ted's statements that, you know, one, asking, you know, why didn't Trump do anything while he was president? And two, doesn't he have a record of cheating workers, especially the kind of low-wage workers that we're talking about here? Well, evidently he regurgitated this promise again recently in Detroit. No more taxes on tips. Which now seems to be kind of maybe a thing for the Republicans to make it look like they actually care about working people. I'm seriously doubting that. But here to share some thoughts on this topic with his most recent story, I've got Dave Jamieson here. He is a labor reporter over at Huffington Post, one of the top labor reporters in the country. Dave, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick. Thanks for having me.
So, you know, I got to tell you, I saw the clip from Las Vegas, you know, and it, for me, it was just one of those things that, yeah, you know, Las Vegas, you know, the Culinary Union is really powerful there. You know, the workers are really engaged. They're a political force to be dealt with. This is an issue that's important to them. You get it there. But now he's reiterated it in Detroit. So it seems to me that this is maybe something that they think that he thinks he's going to be able to divide, especially low wage workers on.
Yeah, I was wondering when he first brought this up, if it was just something he came up with on the fly and would move on and forget about. But that doesn't appear to be the case. Not only did he bring it up in Detroit, my colleague Arthur Delaney, who I co-reported with, was running around the Hill talking to lawmakers about it. And Republicans told him that this was like the one policy that Trump was really interested in when he met with them on Capitol Hill last week. So it's looking right now like it's gonna stick around. Of course, like a lot of Trump ideas This one isn't fully fleshed out. You know, he's famous for saying, like, we're going to release details in a couple weeks. I don't know how fleshed out it is or how much he's tried to, like, build an actual coalition, because this will require literally changing the tax code. Probably would have been a good time to do it when he actually changed the tax code as president. But the reality is a lot of tax stuff is going to be up for grabs next year when they have to, Congress has to go back and figure out, you know, what to do about some of these expiring, tax measures from the reform that was already done. So, you know, I think it'll actually be talked about. It is certainly a long shot.
Yeah, it's one of those things where when I first heard it, I'm going, well, I guess we'll be getting CEOs who are getting tips at some point because they're going to figure out how to use this this pledge to destroy, you know, Social Security, Medicare, you name it. This is the way to destroy employment in this country. Another way, at least that was my thought. I'm curious yours.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, it's pitched as kind of free money. I mean, who doesn't want more money? Who doesn't want to be taxed less? But there's all kinds of problems that you know, would very well arise from this. One being is just like all employers like leaning even more into tipping. I mean, what we've seen in you know, the dining world is we have this pretty unique system here in the U.S. where, especially with the tipped minimum wage in so many places not moving at all for years and years, a larger and larger share of workers' tips are unpredictable and coming from the tipping side. And, you know, if you change this policy with the tax code, it would accelerate that. And we'd probably see employers even, you know, outside of restaurants wanting to move to a, tipped form of wages because they wouldn't be taxed. And we're already at a point, I think, where a lot of customers are annoyed with, you know, post-pandemic, growth in tipping and the tipping prompts. And you hear it called tipping fatigue or, you know, stuff like that. And a funny example is I was like recently I bought a fishing rod online, and at checkout, the company encouraged me to tip their warehouse workers, which it's kind of like, what are we doing here? How about we just pay the warehouse workers like what they should be paid, you know, rather than try to have them, you know, bake gratuities into what they're being paid. So I think that's all stuff that would probably worsen if we saw this change in the tax code.
Well, I think what they also know is that a lot of people are going to be guilted into, well, you know, I guess a percentage. And that's a win for them, because I question whether they're going to actually share those tips or not. And, you know, a real quick story, when, you know, years and years ago, when my wife and I were first at the beginning of dating, she used to do these horse tours. You take you on trail rides and stuff with this big company. And I was a big brother to a kid, and we went up to take this tour. And at the end of it, you know, they give you an envelope and say, hey, you know, if you like the ride, you know, tip your tour guide. And I really liked my tour guide, so I left a fairly hefty tip in there, you know, just to show my gratitude or just being stupid. And it wasn't until years later that I found out she never got that tip. She had no idea that I left anything, because the company that they worked for took all the tips and then gave them like a week's vacation at the end of the year instead of all of the money that they were collecting, they were putting in their pocket, which is why when I give a tip, I put it in cash, usually in the person's hand or somewhere where they grab it, because I don't want the business putting it in their pocket. I want the worker getting it.
Yeah, and one thing, this was the whole point of the story I recently wrote about Trump and this issue, is that, well, while he was in office, when he had a chance to sort of do policies that could improve work for tipped workers, what they did was they tried to change gratuity law to give employers more control over workers' tips. And this created one of the, it was actually quite controversial at the time. Of course, it was buried under like even bigger controversies, you know, in the Trump years. But there was a real uproar about it, because the Labor Department even projected that if this Trump plan went through, that they would see a massive transfer, as they called it, from tipped workers to their employers. Because the way this proposal was written, it really gave employers wide latitude to decide what to do with tips, which is, actually under wage and hour law is you know, there's firm lines around what you can do.
Yeah.
And it required Democrats getting involved and attaching a rider to, you know, to a spending bill to make sure that employers couldn't pocket workers' tips under this new Trump rule. And another thing he did was he you know, made it easier for employers to pay workers, you know, the tipped rate for non-tipped work. You know, and a perfect example of this is like rolling napkins or you know, mopping the bathroom floors if you're a server at a restaurant. They wanted to make it easier to give you $2.13 an hour rather than the $7.25 an hour. And, you know, that was something Biden, rolled back when he came into office. So Trump has a record here on this issue of tipped work. And it's I don't think it's one to be proud of.
Yeah, no, I'm right there with you. And I got to imagine, as an employer himself, I'm sure if you dig back into a lot of the goings on at his casinos and those places, you're going to find a lot of shenanigans around this.
Well, I do recall during his first run, there was, you know, quite a lot of coverage of fights over debts with vendors, you know, through his various businesses, where lots and lots of people said that they'd been stiffed.
Yeah. No, but this is, again, one of these things that, where my mind goes, why are we talking about the lowest wage workers and using them as a political football instead of saying, hey, maybe we raise that minimum wage up so that number's higher, so that workers at least get a raise that they're guaranteed of, instead of a gimmick of, you know, hey, you might get to keep your tips. Because as I understand it, and help me here if I'm wrong, because it's been a while since I've had a conversation with a tipped worker about their conditions, but I seem to remember people telling me that they were taxed on 8% of their checks total. The assumption was they were going to get 15. They were taxed on 8%. So whether you paid them 0 or 15% or 20 or 30 or whatever, they were taxed at 8%. So it seems to me that you could move that number a little bit if that's the case. But I don't know about doing away with it.
Yeah, I mean, look, right now, tips are supposed to be reported as wages. And I mean, obviously, we know that a lot of that is probably underreported because people, you know, don't fully report their cash tips. But I think these days the IRS has a pretty good handle on what any restaurant brings in because of the proliferation of, you know, of credit, of buying, of dining out on credit. But as you mentioned earlier, another you know, big facet of this is the payroll tax issue. And if suddenly you are not taxing what is, it can be a pretty sizable portion of income, there's ramifications down the road, you know, for people when it comes to Social Security.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to this. Me, again, I want to see the bottom raised like anyone else. I want to see people be able to make a living wage. But not at the expense of destroying all of the programs that we need for workers. And really fundamentally, I think if this were to happen, you would change employment in this country really quickly away from traditional employment to everyone being a gig worker working for tips.
Yeah, I mean, I do think we could see a really, really dramatic change because of this. Another reason why I personally am not, you know, taking it too seriously, I've been, you know, obviously, like everybody, I've been plenty wrong about you know, Trump over the years, but this one does seem like quite a long shot.
So this the plan here is probably with that the replacement for Obamacare is what you're telling me.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that plan is it's right around the corner.
Yeah, it's coming any day now. Take a deep breath.
I think they'll be rolling it out on Monday, I'm sure.
Take a deep breath. I do want to change topics real quick. I see that California has just fined Amazon something like $6 million for violating their state's new warehouse safety law. Any word on that?
Yeah. So California a couple years ago implemented this warehouse safety law where you have to disclose to workers, if you're operating a warehouse in the state, you got to tell your workers like what the productivity expectations are. And the whole idea is to prevent injuries so you're not cracking the whip on people and making them run like in the hamster wheel because they don't know what the quota is. And it's also to prevent people from having to work through their breaks and that sort of thing. And so this was, the labor commissioner announced today that they just dropped, fines of nearly $6 million on Amazon for violations at two warehouses in Southern California. And, you know, when it comes to workplace safety violations, as you know, Rick, that $6 million is quite large, actually. You normally don't see federal OSHA dropping fines like that unless, you know, some people have died.
It's a big fine, but to Amazon, it's a rounding error.
It's true. It is a tiny rounding error. However, this could become a problem for Amazon. It's because it's not just California. New York also passed a law that's sort of based on the California one, where same thing. Workers have a right to know the productivity quotas. And so it's part of this broader, legislative pushback against, you know, Amazon and what people see as a grueling or capricious, work pace in these places where, and I've talked to so many warehouse workers over the years and people who just one day, you know, they were temping at Amazon or whatever, and then they were just fired. They didn't really know why. They thought they were doing okay. Amazon sent me a statement today saying, you know, that they're appealing this, they're fighting the fines, and their claim is that they don't have a quota system. What they have is a peer-to-peer evaluation system. And what the labor commissioner replied to that was what you're describing is exactly what we're trying to stop here. You know, I think Amazon is saying we don't have like a firm number that everyone is held to. You're just sort of like, you know, disciplined by a supervisor, or you're free to discuss how you're doing with your supervisor. What the commissioner is saying is like, people don't know what's going on, what they're being held to, and that's a big problem.
A peer-to-peer? Explain that to me.
They did not go into it in great detail. I think what they're saying is that, you know, people are not held to a uniform standard, that you are, that a peer, in this case, I imagine a supervisor, will have discussions with you on how you're doing and how your rate is. You know, their claim is that they don't actually have what we would consider quotas.
Yeah. You know how you solve this problem? Legislation and going about this is one way, but letting those workers unionize, getting them to sit down and hammer this stuff out on paper so that I actually know and I actually understand what a peer-to-peer system is. Because I guess I'm confused, because my mind goes, is this something where you got 10 workers and five of them are producing at this level, so that's the new quota? You got a bunch of younger workers, the older workers can't keep up. I got a bunch of questions here.
Yeah, and I think just the most basic thing that a union contract would bring is a grievance procedure for this whole thing, where,
yep,
you know, where the company would have to sort of better document, how someone is not doing the job. And if there was a dispute over it, there would be a grievance process where a worker could air their case. Of course, that's not what you have right now.
And finally, I got to get your thoughts on something else that just broke. The NLRB issued a new ruling on this Station Casinos case. What I'm guessing is the first order requiring the company to bargain under the CMEX framework.
Yeah, the CMEX framework was this big new thing the board did last year, where it's basically going to, make it easier for the board to order companies to bargain when they've broken the law during a union campaign. And there's been a few rulings from agency judges. There's been three so far where they recommend a CMEX order. This was the first time where the board issued a decision and weighed in and said there should be a CMEX order here. So it's a big deal. And as you know, Rick, I mean, the Culinary Union in Las Vegas has been in this many years battle with Station Casinos, real yeah, ugly one, trying to unionize that place. They have, you know, they've successfully organized so much of the Vegas Strip and downtown, and Stations has been a real holdout. So I think this is like another legal win for them on that front. And it's a pretty big deal. And I'll just note, I didn't know this until I read the decision when it came out, but one a great detail in there is a couple of days before the election, Station Casinos gave everybody free stakes that had been branded "Vote No." you know, burned right into the stakes.
Wow.
And there's nothing, there's no violation inherent in giving away a free stake. But what the board said was that they were, that workers had identified the quality of the food they were given at work as a major source of, as a top concern for them. And the company here was trying, was basically trying to say, vote no, and you're gonna get steak.
Yeah. For how long? That's the question that I would have with this. But real quick, for those who don't know what the CMEX framework is, real quick, can you walk me through it?
Yeah, sure. So it's a little complicated, but you know, the short version is that now when a majority of workers sign union cards, they go to management and say, we desire to have a union. The company then has a choice. They can either say, okay, you have the numbers, we recognize the union, let's bargain. If they don't want to do that, they have to file a petition themselves to hold a union election. So then a union election is held, and if it's documented that the company commits unfair labor practices that warrant setting aside the election, they can be ordered to bargain. So a lot of times now you'll see like a rerun election, like where the company kind of messed with things and the vote was tainted. You got to go back and do and redo things. Here, the board will just say, you're going to bargain.
No, this is what I've been saying for a very long time. We absolutely desperately need, after what happened in Alabama at Amazon, you know, I was saying this should be the case where that is the way things works. I'm glad to see we're finally moving in that direction. Maybe the next time Amazon does what they did before, maybe it'll happen. But Dave, I appreciate the time. As always, great reporting. Love the work. Hope you'll come back and talk to us again real soon.
Thanks, Rick. Great talking with you.
Good stuff. Dave Jamieson, labor reporter there at Huffington Post. You want to check out his work? We'll get links out on social media. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1865. That was the day that 2,000 Union soldiers marched into Galveston, Texas. With them, they carried the news that those enslaved were now free. The Confederate General Robert E. Lee had actually surrendered more than 2 months earlier. Why then was there a delay in delivering the news of emancipation to Texas? It might have been that there were not enough federal troops to enforce the order. It has also been speculated that freedom was postponed to allow enough time for the enslaved workforce to harvest one last crop of cotton before freedom. Whatever the reason, General Order No. 3 finally was delivered. It read, quote, "The people of Texas are informed that in accordance with a proclamation of the Executive of the United States, all slaves are free. This involves an absolute equality of rights and rights of property between former masters and slaves, and the connection existing between them becomes that between employer and free laborer." On hearing of the news, the newly freed people celebrated. The next year, they celebrated again in a holiday that became known as Juneteenth. In the years that followed, the holiday spread to other cities. But in the segregated South, black residents were often barred from holding Juneteenth events on public land. That is why in 1872, several black men in Houston purchased property and established Emancipation Park as a space to hold the celebration. In 1980, Texas became the first state to formally recognize Juneteenth. Today, this holiday is celebrated in black neighborhoods across the country, with gatherings, barbecues, songs, and remembrances of the fight for freedom. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. I gotta tell you, still, it boils my blood. It's gotta be almost 30 years ago that tip incident happened with my wife. And look, you know, I still remember because it makes me angry. But I had taken my little brother through Big Brothers Big Sisters, which I'm a huge supporter of, and I think people should, if you have the time, take on a little. Changed my life as a child and also as an adult, so I've seen it from both sides. Huge supporter. But you know, took him on this trail ride. You know, hey, we're going to go up into the woods and we're going to ride, you know, mules and you know, hit it off with my future wife at the time. And you know, I figured I'm gonna be a big tipper here. And it wasn't until years later that she told me, no, you handed me the envelope. And they were watching with, you know, from inside the office to ensure that she handed that in. And they never got a dime of that tip money. And this is one of those reasons I've always been against tipping. I think that workers should earn a solid wage. I think you should be paid for your time. It shouldn't be based on the generosity or the if you winked and nodded or smiled enough. I think workers should be guaranteed a fair wage, a consistent wage. Their work has value. It should be compensated as such. And for me, eliminating the tipped wage would ensure that all workers receive a minimum wage that allows them to support themselves and their families. But that said, every time I bring this up, I get people who are, you know, or no, we have to defend it. And because look, some people do better in a tipped situation. Some, most workers end up, you know, being where the employer puts their risk. Because understand, the tip system is an unstable system. The income instability that comes out of it, because incomes fluctuate from week to week, day to day, month to month, and you can't plan a life around the generosity of others. And wage theft is huge in this. As I said, you know, the people stealing your tips, your employer maybe pocketing some of them, or hey, you came out of a credit card, we're going to charge you the fee of your tips. It's crazy what we allow to happen to working people. And then you look at the system, you talk about the gender and the racial disparities, and you know, who are tipped workers? They're majority women, majority minorities. That's creating an environment, a workspace, where employers have the ability to, well, cheat, enrich themselves at the risk of others. And for me, getting rid of it would be just simple, and it would be fair. The simplicity of it, you don't have to have some complicated system of, oh, did you declare all of your tips? Do we take a percentage of your checks? Do we do all of these things to ensure that Uncle Sam gets his due, but still allows people to keep money in their pockets? So for me, just ending the tip system. See, I was always taught that a tip was for exceptional service. You do really well, you tip somebody, hey, thank you for that. Not as part of their living. Now, I've always been a very generous tipper. It's one of those things that I try and do when I can, when I've got cash in my pocket. I always try and leave cash so that, well, they don't have to declare as much as I'm giving. Because I understand it's a tough job. It's a difficult job. It's a job that a lot of people don't want to do. And, you know, it's tough for people to make a living. But, you know, there are some people who make good tips in the higher end restaurants, and they want to keep it right where it is. But the fact that the argument for keeping the tip system is mostly around employers, you know, it's a cost control for employers. You know, they don't have to bear the brunt of the risk of paying that pesky minimum wage. You know, it would have and don't forget, Rick, it would have a huge impact on small employers. And this is, again, that argument that is being made. You know, you talk about wanting to keep mom and pop around, and I do. I think consumers should be going to mom and pop an awful lot more than we do. Put down the Amazon, go to Main Street. But there's a better way of ensuring that mom and pop can be competitive than doing it on the backs of low-wage workers. And that's always been my position. There's got to be a way. We're smart. We can figure this stuff out if we wanted to. And to have someone like Trump say, we're just going to do away with it, that doesn't solve the problem of people still living, you know, tip to tip, handout to handout. And for me, the rationale of all of this is work should be respected. I don't care what you do. Work should be rewarded. I don't care what you do. You should be able to make a living on the work that you do. Seems simple to me. But I want to hear your thoughts. You got any tip horror stories? I most certainly want to hear it. You can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. If you got any questions, comments, something on your mind, there's where you email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Miss any portion of the show or any of our programs, podcast. Wherever you get your favorite podcast, you'll find ours, or just go to therickSmithShow.com, all right there. Also, freespeech.org for our video content. Highly suggest heading over there as well. As always, appreciate your time. Thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at Rick. You're listening to Mad Radio. WMDX 1580 AM Columbus. W224 EG Madison. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.